67 years ago, many people thought that we were destined for super speed travel.
The possibility of leaving Adelaide, fulfilling a luncheon engagement in London, or attending the theatre or the opera, say, and being home again within 24 hours is no longer a fanciful dream.
But most of us still can't even get to work on time. So where did things go so wrong? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a special series about why we didn't end up in the future we were promised. It's available now on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this episode contains the name of an Aboriginal person who has died. Kumanjai Walker only interacted with Constable Zachary Rolfe for a matter of seconds before he was shot. But when investigating the cause of his death, the coroner looked back more than half a century. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to Chapter 4 of the case of Kumanjai Walker.
Constable Zachary Rolfe fatally shot the 19-year-old.
Sometimes I think about how he must have felt in his last moments. Was he scared?
And I can promise you, consequences will flow.
Constable Rolfe has pleaded not guilty to one charge of murder.
Prosecutors took the case to the High Court.
There's been a huge outpouring of grief.
An organisation with significant hallmarks of institutional racism.
When we are going to get justice? When?
Whenever someone dies in police custody, there is an inquest, a mandatory inquest, this investigation into what unfolded. And as we've been discussing in this series, Zachary Rolfe shot Kumanjai Walker and Kumanjai Walker died in Yindamu in 2019. And helping us tell this story, taking us through the trial and now through the inquest is Melissa McKay, who has been working for the ABC and covering this trial through this whole story. And Mel, you know, I talk about how an inquest is, you know, a kind of standard part of this process, but this one must have been incredibly highly anticipated.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially because by the time we got to the coronial inquest part of this case, it had been almost 3 years since Kumanjai Walker had died and we'd seen a criminal trial already. And so we'd heard some of this story and so much had been written about this case, but there was still so much more to learn.
And this is why I'm so keen to talk through this process with you, Mel, because we learn so much through this process. I mean, we learn a lot in the trial of Zachary Rolfe. We learn more in some of the details that are released after the end of that trial. But it's through this inquest that we really start to hear kind of the driving forces at play in the shooting of Kumanjai Walker.
Absolutely. The coroner digs well beyond the night of the 9th of November 2019. We hear about things that had happened in the lead up to and things that happened after the shooting. A lot of the headlines that came from this coronial inquest were around systemic racism within the Northern Territory Police Force, something which a lot of Yuppa or Walpri people had talked about their experiences of, but they say it had never really been believed before.
Mm. You know, some of the detail around, you know, Zachary Rolfe's career prior to the shooting take on a new light when they're considered as a whole. And we'll talk through some of that as well. But I mean, Mel, in the first instance, what is the goal of an inquest like this?
Realistically, the goal of a coronial inquest is to determine the cause and circumstances of a death. In this case, a death in custody. So we are hearing about everything that led to the point of Kumanjai Walker's death. The coroner has a much broader scope of inquiry than a criminal trial. She can determine what it is that she would like to hear. She can determine what it is that is relevant to her investigation. Her goal is ultimately to make findings and recommendations to prevent this from ever happening again.
Mm. And I mean, we've already talked about the trial of Zachary Rolfe. How is an inquest different to a criminal trial?
an inquest is purely investigative. You know, the coroner can't charge or prosecute anyone at the end of this. She can make recommendations to prosecutors, you know, to re-examine certain elements of the evidence, but she can't make any findings that any one particular person committed a crime. Everyone who has anything to do with what happened on the night of the shooting in this case is legally represented at a coronial inquest. So we had two bar tables full of barristers representing Zachary Rolfe, the police force, the police union, the health department, Kumanjayi Walker's family, the Yuendumu community. The North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency was represented. There were so many interested parties who wanted to have a say and be a part of this investigation.
Yeah, and the way that the NT coroner, Elizabeth Armitage, you know, starts this journey is kind of unusual. How did they set up and how did they run the inquest? Where was that all done?
The inquest itself was held in Alice Springs, in the local court in Alice Springs, which is still about 300 kilometres from Yuendumu, but is the closest sort of courtroom with the facilities to run an inquest of this size and scale. And I think it's important to note here that Elizabeth Armitage was new to being the Northern Territory coroner at the time of this inquest. This was really the first sort of significant inquest that she sat on as the new Northern Territory coroner. And in doing so, she set a tone that was quite different from anything I'd seen before in the NT.
What do you mean by that? How?
Well, this inquest, not only was it massive in size and scale, you know, it was initially set to run for 3 months, which is huge to begin with, but the court had also gone to fairly significant lengths to include the Yuendumu community in this process. There was a live stream set up from the coroner's court so that anyone could access proceedings at any point, you know, via YouTube or via the court's website. That hadn't happened before in the Northern Territory Coroner's Court. We also had weekly summaries of the evidence translated into Walpuri language so that members of the Yuendumu community who don't speak English as a first language were able to get an understanding of what had happened in court that week. And the coroner also began every sitting with an acknowledgement of country. And we also started this whole process with a cultural lesson in, you know, Walpuri culture.
Mel, as you're talking about, this is a huge undertaking. Yeah, this inquest is set down for a long time. It ends up running kind of over a few different stints. It ends up being a bit broken apart. And we'll get to all of that. But I want to start at the kind of the first kind of run of this inquest. So we're in Alice Springs. What are we hearing? What's coming out in this initial stage?
Some of the first key evidence that we hear is around text messages found on Zachary Rolfe's phone. And we know that there was a download of his mobile phone that happened during the criminal investigation. There was some 8,000 pages of text messages that were put to the coroner. And in some of those text messages, we see and we hear for the first time the use of racial slurs among police officers on the Alice Springs beat. We also hear quite a bit about Zachary Rolfe's early career. We learn that he was in the army in Queensland for several years before he joined the police force in the Northern Territory. And we also start to learn a little bit more about Kumanjayi Walker and his upbringing and what his life was like in Yuendumu. It became quite clear quite quickly that Elizabeth Armitage was going a lot deeper than what happened on the night of the shooting, that she was looking at all of the reasons why Kumanjayi Walker and Zachary Rolfe ended up on this same path to begin with. And to do that, she was going back years.
What did the inquest hear about Zachary Rolfe's past, his history?
The inquest went quite broad when it came to what we learned about Zachary Rolfe himself. And a lot of that we learned initially through his text messages and body-worn camera footage from previous arrests that he'd made while he was a police officer on the Alice Springs beat. So we learned that Zachary Rolfe joined the police force in 2016. So by the time Kumanjayi was shot, he had been serving for just under 3 years. Prior to joining the police force, he had been in the Defence Force based in Queensland, and he had wanted to join the Special Forces, but that he'd gotten into a bit of trouble as a young soldier. And so for a period of time, he wasn't able to do that. So ultimately, he then left the ADF to join the police.
And was the Northern Territory Police his first choice?
No, it wasn't. He had tried, we learnt through this inquest, to join several police forces across the country. He'd never been to the Northern Territory before, and so it wasn't his first choice. But we learnt throughout this process that he had been blocked from applying for the Queensland Police for 10 years at the time that he applied for the Northern Territory Police.
Why?
He'd lied on his application to the Queensland Police Service. So we learned throughout this process that Zachary Rolfe, during his time in the ADF based in Townsville, he had been in trouble with the police for public nuisance, violent behaviour, a fine that he was issued for being involved in what he described as a fight that was happening on the street that he had gotten involved in to try to break up. And he'd gotten in trouble with the police. He'd been issued a fine and he'd paid that. He was also in trouble within the ADF for stealing a packet of tobacco, he said, from a colleague on a rugby trip, on a boys' trip. And, you know, that he'd gone to return it and then gotten in trouble for stealing it in the first place. And so these were two incidents that ultimately Zachary Rolfe described as quite minor. But because he hadn't disclosed those on his application to the Queensland Police Service, they told him that he wasn't welcome to apply to the Queensland Police for another 10 years. So he ultimately was applying elsewhere.
And so he ends up working for the Northern Territory Police. He's based in Alice Springs. What do we see and what do we hear about his conduct as a police officer during that time?
In his early years as a police officer in Alice Springs, Zachary Rolfe was kind of the go-to guy for a lot of his superiors. He had a great track record for, you know, getting the job done. This is a young man who had duxed his course in the police training academy. When he was very new on the beat in Alice Springs, he was awarded a bravery medal for jumping into a flooded river to save a couple of tourists. You know, he was known for being bold and brave and the guy to call when you needed to get the job done.
What did the inquest hear about the other side of Zachary Rolfe's policing though? Because there was another side, right?
There was, and it started to become clear sort of in the months leading up to ultimately the death of Kumanjayi Walker that we heard throughout the inquest there had become sort of a pattern of behaviour that some superiors were starting to get concerned about, but that a lot of these sort of, I guess, so-called red flags weren't really picked up at the time. The coroner heard that Zachary Rolfe was starting to be picked up for not using his body-worn camera and that for people that he was arresting to be injured by the time the arrest had been completed. And there was one incident in particular where Zachary Rolfe was found by a judge of the local court to have lied about an arrest in which an Aboriginal man had ended up with a head injury.
Mm. And I mean, as well as hearing a lot more about the background of Zachary Rolfe, the coroner, Elizabeth Armitage, also made a real effort to explore kind of everything that led to this shooting, right? So she also heard a lot about Kumanjayi Walker's life and And there are even hearings in Yuendamu.
There were. And this is another, you know, really interesting element of, I think, particularly Elizabeth Armitage's approach is going to the place where the shooting had taken place. And this isn't something that no coroner has ever done before, but on this scale, it was quite significant. The entire courtroom, media included, was invited to Yuendamu over a couple of days to see these places that the court had heard so much about and that the court had really only seen before in Zachary Rolfe's body-worn camera footage. So for a lot of people, myself included, for the coroner, for a lot of the lawyers involved, we'd spent so much time looking at body-worn camera footage from police walking through Yuendamu that it was a really significant moment to actually be in Yuendamu in person and seeing this place up close.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of the viewings that courts do sometimes when a jury is taken out of the room and taken to a location to get that kind of understanding of it. It feels, you know, is it the same kind of vibe? Is that the thinking behind it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, those hearings in Yuendamu weren't to take any official evidence. It was for the coroner to view the place where Kumanjayi Walker had died. She went to House 511. She met with members of Kumanjayi's immediate family. She went to the police station where he ultimately died and, you know, was welcomed into these places to hear from Walpiri people on their own terms. Kumanjayi Walker was kind of almost, I guess, a case study of the support or lack thereof in the bush for young people. The coroner examined a lot of what we had already heard about Kumanjayi's criminal history, which was talked about a lot during the criminal trial of Zachary Rolfe. But she was looking at it, I guess, from more of a perspective of trying to understand how and why we got there. You know, we heard that Kumanjayi had really struggled to engage in school and, you know, that he had spent a lot of time in his youth under some form of court restraint, whether that be in youth detention or under some sort of court order. But we also heard that, you know, there were some programs where he really thrived and that he had, when he had structure and a program to attend, this Mount Theo program near Yuendamu, which, you know, is no longer operating, that he had done really well in those sorts of situations. And so the coroner was really looking at it from this sort of long-term holistic view of how and why Kumanjayi ended up on the path that he did.
And this all comes to a head on a night in November 2019. That's when the paths of Kumanjayi Walker and Zachary Rolfe cross. I mean, what did we hear in the inquest about how that kind of unfolded?
This was the first time we heard directly from members of the Yuendamu community who were there on the night of the shooting. So we heard from Kumanjayi's family members who were sat outside of the police station that night, knowing that he had been shot, but not knowing what was going on inside, not knowing whether he was okay. And so the coroner saw all of these videos that had been taken from community members on the night of the shooting, really showing their fear and their anger and their lack of understanding of what had gone on that night. The coroner learnt a lot about this 5 a.m. arrest plan that was supposed to take place the following day to, you know, effect a safe arrest of Kumanjayi Walker, but that hadn't happened. She learnt a lot about, you know, a plane flying in to the community that night and this ruse where police essentially tried to trick the community into thinking that Kumanjayi Walker was getting help that night.
What do you mean? Like the plane flies in and there's this belief that it's like a Royal Flying Doctor plane or something, but instead of it being that, it's what, bringing in reinforcements?
Exactly, yeah. But from the community's perspective that night, they were sitting outside of the police station And remember, there were no nurses based in Yuendamu that night. They had evacuated earlier that day for fear of their own safety after a string of break-ins in the community. And so there were nurses that came in from another town nearby, and then those ambulances at some point during the night sped off to the airstrip where a plane had landed. And so the community at that point believed that Kumanjayi was getting out and was getting help. And we learnt during the inquest that that had been done on purpose to essentially trick the community into thinking that's what was happening, whereas ultimately they didn't learn until the next morning that Kumanjayi Walker had died not long after he'd been shot and that his body was still in the police station that night.
Wow. And I mean, that's the night of the shooting, Mel. You were talking before about how broad this inquiry goes, how broadly this inquest goes. What else did she end up looking into around, you know, the kind of the police force and, you know, all the services that are kind of attached to this?
A lot of the headlines that came from this inquest have been around racism in the Northern Territory Police Force, the use of racial slurs in text messages among police. But she also did look into things like police recruitment, their training, support services for police. You know, she explored a lot about how overworked police in the Northern Territory are and the sorts of traumatic incidents that they're witness to and what kind of impact that can have on the mental state of police officers in the Northern Territory as well.
And I mean, the same week that you have the coroner, Elizabeth Armitage, in Yuendamu, hearing these stories, that is the same week that we hear from Zachary Rolfe at this inquest as well.
Yeah, this was a really interesting juxtaposition, I think. You know, we spent the first half of the week in Yuendamu and then the second half of the week in the Alice Springs local court hearing from Zachary Rolfe himself, but not for long.
How come?
He invoked a legal argument, which ultimately went to the Court of Appeal, essentially arguing that he shouldn't be forced to answer questions which could incriminate himself.
I mean, I've seen in courts in other trials and, you know, just through the process that there's often like something that could be granted to someone giving evidence to protect them from any sort of prosecution related to what they say. I mean, is that something that was on the table for Zachary Rolfe in this instance?
Zachary Rolfe was concerned in this case that certificate that the coroner could grant wouldn't protect him from disciplinary action within the Northern Territory Police Force. So at this point, Zachary Rolfe is still a serving member of the NT Police. He's just on leave from his job.
Do we end up hearing much from him at all in this first kind of block of hearings?
Not at all. He answered a couple of quick questions about, you know, his name and age and his job. But as soon as he's asked that first question about his text messages, he invokes this argument that he shouldn't have to answer questions on the basis of self-incrimination. And that argument then goes straight up to the Supreme Court. And it's another year or so before we actually hear from him.
And Mel, these kind of breaks that you're describing here end up becoming like a theme of this inquest. It ends up being this real stop-start process. How long until we eventually hear from Zachary Rolfe?
Yeah, it's a couple of years into what was supposed to be a three-month coronial inquest before we really hear sort of substantial evidence from Zachary Rolfe himself. He, as we said, had filed a number of appeals to try to avoid giving evidence as a whole and then also to try to narrow the scope of the questions that he could be asked. But eventually he got in the witness box and over 5 days gave some of the most explosive evidence the coroner heard.
Like what?
Zachary Rolfe accused the Northern Territory Police Force's most elite unit, the TRG, the Territory Response Group, of widespread racism. He presented to the coroner evidence of annual awards being handed out at the TRG's Christmas parties, poking fun at Aboriginal people, the widespread use of racist language. Zachary Rolfe said it was normalised in the police force, that he was used to hearing racial slurs thrown around the muster room, that was the culture within the police force.
Was this the first time we had seen proof of something like that?
It's the first time we see evidence of racism being widespread among the police force. You know, over the first few months and years of this inquest, a lot of the allegations of racism have stemmed from text messages on Zachary Rolfe's phone, conversations between himself and some of his direct superiors and colleagues within Alice Springs. And so it was quite easy for the police force at that point to argue, oh, well, it's just a handful of bad apples. But when Zachary Rolfe gets in the witness box and he presents certificates that have been handed out at Christmas parties only a couple of years ago, using racial slurs, using blackface in pictures on some of these certificates that are handed out, it becomes quite clear quite quickly that this is more than just a handful of bad apples in the Alice Springs police station.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, Mel, we're not going to name these awards or what they were known as, because they feature a word that's what I would describe as a kind of tier one racial slur. I don't think I've ever even said that word, so I don't want to say it on the pod. But if you do want to read more about these, I'll put a link in the episode description to some of Mel's reporting, so you can check that out. But Mel, it's interesting that Zachary Rolfe, someone who has been charged with and acquitted of murdering an Aboriginal man, is the one to present all of these details about racism in the Northern Territory Police. I mean, it's something that becomes a huge part of this story that we'll talk about more in our next episodes. But we also learned at kind of this point of the inquest about how Zachary Rolfe kind of first hears of Kumanjai Walker. It's because of something you told us about in our first episode, when Kumanjai Walker ran at police with an axe, and the body-worn video of that makes its way back to Alice Springs Police Station, and it's watched a lot.
Yeah, it is. Zachary Rolfe and some of his colleagues watch the footage of this axe incident several times from the Alice Springs police station, and they're shocked that this hasn't been flagged across the police force as a serious incident, a serious threat against police. You know, a young person threatening officers with an axe. Zachary Rolfe and his team, you know, some of his team in Alice Springs watched this footage over and over before they are ultimately called out to Yuendumu.
Yeah, and I mean, Mel, this is a video that gets watched, like, a lot. It really does the rounds of the NT police.
Yeah, it does. And the system shows that Zachary Rolfe accessed that footage himself six times on that day.
Mm. And I mean, you spoke a bit about Zachary Rolfe's body-worn camera footage earlier, and, you know, this kind of what seemed to be a kind of pattern of increasing force during arrests. Can you take us a little bit deeper into that? What sort of things did the coroner hear?
So the coroner heard that Zachary Rolfe had used force 46 times in his years on the Alice Springs beat. Now, she heard that that wasn't necessarily an abnormally high number, because a use of force can be anything from placing handcuffs on someone to pushing someone into a wall. We did hear of five specific incidents which the coroner heard were excessive. And some of these incidents included the arrest of Aboriginal men where they had ended up injured. There was one video in which we saw, Zachary Rolfe chasing a man down the mall in Alice Springs, and he pushes him into sort of a fence set up near a pub. And he's later seen filming that video of his body-worn footage on his phone, texting it to someone and saying, treated him to the old illegal shoulder charge. Turns out that guy that had ended up in a sling after that incident wasn't the person that they were chasing, that they were supposed to be arresting in the first place. And there was another incident involving the arrest of a 14-year-old Aboriginal boy who had hidden in a rubbish bin trying to escape police. And Zachary Rolfe is seen on the body-worn footage slamming the lid closed on the bin with this child inside before pulling the bin onto the ground, essentially spilling this young person out. And he pulls him out of the bin. This young person is saying, you know, I'm sorry, sir, I'm sorry, sir. And Zachary Rolfe then arrests him there. So it's these handful of incidents that the coroner is seeing that happen sort of in the lead up to the shooting of Kumanjayi Walker, which have become somewhat of red flags for some really senior police.
And I mean, Mel, this isn't the first time we've heard from Zachary Rolfe. In our last episode, you know, we're talking about the evidence he gave in his criminal trial and, you know, how kind of helpful he was, I guess, to the jury, like taking the time to explain policing concepts, you know, his training, talking through all of that. Is that the same kind of style that he brought to, you know, was that something that carried through to the inquest when he was giving evidence to Elizabeth Armitage?
It was a totally different demeanour from Zachary Rolfe, at least from my perspective in the courtroom, when he came to give evidence at the coronial inquest. He was still quite calm in the witness box, but he didn't give away anything more than he really needed to a lot of the time. I spoke during the last episode about Zachary Rolfe, you know, walking across town each morning to get to his criminal trial. On the days that he gave evidence at the inquest, he was dropped off in a taxi right out the front door. There wasn't a lot of room for journalists to, you know, chase him with questions between the car and the front door of the courtroom. And even then, he was then sort of whisked away into a back room until it was time to sit in the witness box. And while he was quite calm in giving evidence a lot of the time, answering the questions that he was asked, at points somewhat reluctantly, there were also a few moments where the tension really boiled over.
How?
Well, there was one incident in particular in which there had been sort of some discussion around the identities of people who had been in contact with Zachary Rolfe being protected. And at one point, counsel assisting said the name of someone whose identity was supposed to be suppressed. And Zachary Rolfe swore from the witness box in that moment, which is quite an extraordinary thing to happen in a courtroom, you know, where it's usually quite a proper place to be. And there's a lot of rules around contempt of court and the way that you behave in front of a judge. And so there were a few moments like that. We also had a couple of incidents where there was quite clear tension at the bar table. Zachary Rolfe's barrister was Michael Abbott KC at this point, who had replaced David Edwardson in the coronial inquest. And he was raising a lot of issues with the way that Zachary Rolfe was being questioned by counsel assisting Peggy Dwyer SC. And he at one point raised an issue with Dr. Dwyer's tone and the way she was phrasing questions. And she snapped. Eventually, she turns down to the other end of the bar table and she says, "It's 2024. There are lady barristers. My learned friend is just going to have to get used to it."
Yeah, wow. And I mean, something I've noticed in courts is that, you know, a bit of passive aggression isn't unusual, but it sounds like in this case, Mel, that was really dialed up to 11.
Absolutely. And that happened a lot throughout this process. There was so much tension at that bar table. There were so many people. I'm talking 15, 16 barristers at points representing different parties with really different views and different approaches to this inquest, and all trying to protect their own clients who had a very different interest in what was happening and what the coroner was exploring. And so there was a lot of really palpable tension between barristers
Yeah. And Mel, I mean, we were talking about Zachary Rolfe giving evidence. I mean, how was he when he was talking to the coroner, to Elizabeth Armitage? I mean, I imagine that along with the kind of various parties on this bar table, she's also asking a lot of the questions too, right?
Sometimes. The questions are mostly asked by the lawyers at the bar table. Elizabeth Armitage does interject at times, but not all that often. There was one moment, though, where Zachary Rolfe was sort of asked more broadly about this process. And, you know, at this point where several years after Kumanjayi Walker had been shot, and Zachary Rolfe says that he doesn't feel any anger at all. He's just bored of the situation and ready to move on.
I mean, yeah, as we've talked about, Mel, this is a process, you know, examining the situation that led to the death of Kumanjayi Walker. You know, it's looking at all of the drivers around that. And then we have Zachary Rolfe describing it like that. And I guess, yeah, he's already been found not guilty of murder at this point. Elizabeth Armitage doesn't have any power to kind of charge him with anything in this process. Is he just kind of checked out?
It's hard to say, obviously, what is going through Zachary Rolfe's mind while he's sitting in the witness box. And he was sitting in the witness box for several days. But there is an element that he's got nothing to prove in this situation. You know, the stakes for a coronial inquest are a lot lower than they are for a murder trial. And so he's not at risk of being locked up for 20 years at this point. You know, he's here and has spent the last few years arguing he shouldn't have to be.
Mm. It's not just Rolfe that we hear from during this time, though. There's also other people from his personal life that have some stories too.
Yeah, we hear from Zachary Rolfe's ex-fiance during this time. Now, this is evidence which was ruled inadmissible from the Supreme Court trial, but was allowed into the coronial inquest. And we heard from Claudia Campagnaro, who was engaged to Zachary Rolfe for a period of time prior to the shooting. She talked about some conversations she'd had with Mr. Rolfe, including one where she said that he had told her that he'd like to shoot someone to go on a paid holiday because you would have to be on leave from the police force while it's being investigated.
How does Zachary Rolfe respond to that claim?
Zachary Rolfe denies ever saying that.
I mean, Mel, we hear so much against the Northern Territory Police, and you were describing the bar table before, you know, all of these lawyers, all of these representatives. What does the Northern Territory Police say about all of this?
The Northern Territory Police Force's response was really interesting throughout this coronial inquest because there was a lot that they just accepted. They accepted that this racist language was used among police officers within the Alice Springs Police Force. But it wasn't until those allegations about the Territory Response Group became clear that the police force sort of started to fight back on a lot of these elements, sort of started to argue that, no, we don't know if those certificates are legitimate or not yet. They had five senior police officers write statutory declarations to the coroner denying that those certificates were legitimate or that they had any racial connotations or that there was any racism within the Territory Response Group. It's not until we see the pictures of these certificates that it becomes quite undeniable the racist connotations to what was happening within the TRG.
Yeah, so many of the headlines around this were around the racism within the police force. But, you know, as we've talked about, this has explored so much more than that, right? Like, it's looking at intergenerational trauma. It's going to Yuendumu. It's talking to the people there. It's understanding the situation that, you know, people growing up in that environment face. It's looking at kind of the structures within the police as well as to how people like Zachary Rolfe end up in the position that Zachary Rolfe ends up in. It's such a big picture, but I guess, you know, when it comes down to it, it's the kind of the racism headlines that take over.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's almost disappointing in some ways because there was so much more that the coroner explored. When she looks at health within remote communities and education within remote communities and, you know, the integration of health staff and those who are going and working in Yuendumu. You know, we heard a lot about the fact that people that come in to work in these remote communities don't necessarily integrate themselves into the community that they're working in very well. And so there's all of these sort of little things that the coroner looked at that didn't quite capture the attention that the racism and the excessive force by police did.
Yeah, there are some really big questions that the coroner tries to answer with this inquest, and we find out where she gets to, what recommendations she makes in our episode on Tuesday next week. If you have any questions about anything that we've talked about, if there's something we can explain a bit better, please get in touch, thecaseof@abc.net.au. I've loved seeing all of the emails that have already been coming through, and, you know, so many questions, but also so many thoughts, so many reflections. It's been wonderful to see how deeply you've engaged with this series. So I really appreciate that. We're planning to answer all of them in our episode on Thursday next week. So keep them coming. But before that, we'll have the findings of the inquest in our episode on Tuesday next week. The Case of Kumanjai Walker is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Melissa McKay and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims and to senior cultural advisor Miriam Korowa for their help making this series. This episode was produced on the land of the Gadigal, Turrbal and Wurundjeri people.